Hello, I'm Dr. Amalia Gonyas-Malka. Welcome to Womanity, Woman in Unity, the show that celebrates women's milestone achievements in their struggle for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, democracy, and much more. Joining us today is Dr. Jennifer Veach, who is a physical oceanographer who uses numerical models as a tool to better understand ocean processes, which are difficult to observe in a cohesive way using in situ or satellite data. She is based at the South African Environmental Network, SEON, and heads up the SOMISANA initiative, which stands for a Sustainable Ocean Modeling Initiative, using a South African approach. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Dr. Veach, earlier this year, we spoke to some of your colleagues, Lara Atkinson and Tammy Morris, and this was the first time that we've really had a conversation about women operating in the field of oceanography. So we are very interested to hear more about what you're doing and in this relationship between ocean and climate. So please tell us about the models that you use and the real world applications.
Yes, sure. I'd be happy to. So I head up, as you've said, the SOMISANA initiative at SEON, and we develop ocean models that support society in different ways. So one of the ways in which we do this is to develop ocean forecast models that provide a 5-day forecast of ocean conditions. So basically a weather forecast, but for the ocean. And what this does is gives us the ability to support various coastal and ocean stakeholders. So, for example, we provide support in the case of an oil spill. So if there's an oil spill, we can provide forecast information about where that oil spill might end up so that the cleanup can be assisted. In addition, we can also provide information of where an oil spill came from. And this kind of information is really, really important for management of the marine environment. We can also provide information for search and rescue operations or vessels lost at sea. And we have done so. So we've provided information to SAMHSA, to Integrated Coastal Management at our Department of Forestry and Fisheries. So the other way in which we use models is to provide long-term projections, as well as historical information about how the ocean has changed on longer term timescales. So we'll use our models to understand how the ocean has warmed, how the currents have changed, and how these changes impact the ecosystem. So a lot of the work we do is in conjunction with partners who work on marine ecosystems, but also how these impact coastal communities. So in South Africa, we have a huge fishing industry. West Coast rock lobster is one of our big resources, and our models can help with the important information that they need to understand how these resources are changing. So this is how we feed into policy, and it really supports South Africa's blue economy, a sustainable blue economy.
Such a dynamic set of work that you do, and working across a variety of stakeholders, from search and rescue to fishermen to looking at oil spills and how you can predict movements from where they came from, and also to assist with cleanup. I guess no day is the same.
No, we do many different things. I mean, we have a meeting with academics this morning and then stakeholders this afternoon. So you kind of have to wear your different hats and have them all lined up on your wall. But it certainly is very exciting. It's nice to be able to integrate all of that as well. So research and academia really underscores operational developments. Yeah.
Tapping into some of the things that you've mentioned already, I read that South Africa had recently developed its first ocean current forecast model coupled with an oil trajectory model. And you've mentioned how this has been used in cleanup operations. Can you highlight some real-world examples that have been relatively recent?
Yes, so there is an oil bunkering operation in Algoa Bay, and Algoa Bay also happens to be home to a couple of very important bird colonies, and this bunkering operation is really just a gas station for ships. So they come in, they use the Agulhas Current, which is a really strong current, and it's there for it's a highway for ships, right? So the ships come down the Agulhas Current and they go into Algoa Bay, which is on our south coast, to refuel. And of course, this is risky. This is a risky operation because you're transferring oil from one ship to another. And some time ago, there was an oil spill. Luckily, it wasn't huge, but we were alerted and we were able to respond to that call. In addition, more recently, there was a big oil spill detected, or oil, not a, the spill itself wasn't detected, but oil ended up on a beach. I think it's called Strandfontein, north on the west coast of South Africa, north of Cape Town, and nobody really knew where it came from. And our modeling team at Samisana used their models to go backwards in time. So they seeded the model with a fake oil spill and they reversed the model backwards in time so that we could identify the probable area of origin of this oil. And it's this kind of information that can really help governance activities, and limitations on where ships are being berthed or what kinds of oil they're carrying, or so these are the types of examples that we've used our models to support.
That reverse engineering application is so important to keep people accountable.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I think our trick is just to be very share that we have this ability and to share it with the right people in the right way. So at this point, we need to reach out to Integrated Coastal Management and just develop those partnerships well so that they do respond to us timeous. I mean, reach out to us timeously so that actually something can be done about it.
Talking about disseminating knowledge to the right people, one of the elements that we know about communication is that you have to speak in someone's language and their terms. So, what are some of your approaches to make to almost take out the complexity of the science that you do and make it more accessible to the public and policymakers?
Yeah, Amalaya, that's a very good question. And the whole vision of this next decade, the UN Ocean Decade, is the science we need for the ocean we want. And so it talks about doing the relevant science, but communicating it in such a way that it reaches the right place and it reaches the right ears so that it can be acted upon, so that we can have the ocean that we want in the future. So this is more and more, this element of communication is becoming an integral part of our jobs. And we've never been trained in communication. As a scientist, most scientists I know like to just stay in their offices and work away on their passion project. So it's something that we haven't learned, but we are working on it. And the one thing that we do is to bring in our stakeholders from the beginning, whether it's a science focused project or whether it's an operational service. The idea is to really have them on board from the very beginning so that in the design of the proposal, they are part of the development. This is important because it builds trust, so you can't just develop your science and then go to your community member at the end of the game. Often there are trust issues if you do it in that way. So it's better to build a partnership and through a system of co-design, especially in the development of decision support tools, to have them at the table all the time. You begin to speak the same language. The other important thing about engaging with stakeholders, and there are various types of stakeholders, of course, you've got policymakers, but then you've also got coastal fishing communities, which are very different, but as important, is to acknowledge that they have community knowledge, indigenous knowledge that runs so deep and that is really important for us to integrate with the solutions that we're coming up with. So this co-design process, it's a learning curve for me and many of my colleagues, but we try from the very beginning to engage with our stakeholders, and we can only get better. So we keep trying and engaging with them and communicating them from the with them from the beginning.
Do you find parallels with some of the indigenous knowledge and the findings that you are deriving through research?
So it is interesting. We have a lovely woman who is about to finish her PhD on working with coastal communities on the KZN coastline, and she's been gathering information, indigenous knowledge about their impression of climate change and how it's manifested for them. And her experience has been very interesting in that they have different stories, and it's about how it impacts their daily lives. And it's not always easy to find the parallels between our ocean models and what they're experiencing on the ground. And often it's because these climate change models are global. They're global scale models, and what is actually happening on the ground might present quite differently to what is forecast in terms of the climate models. And one thing that I just want to share, and this again is about trust, is that climate projections are often used to help to managers to limit the fishing happening around the coastline. So often scientists are distrusted by communities because scientists come with the message that they can't fish anymore, and that's their livelihood. So I think that for me just speaks again to us connecting more with the locals, hearing their stories about climate change and what has happened in their community and in their lives, and to try and understand how we can sort of meet them halfway and how they can improve our models, So our models aren't perfect, so we really need their input to try to understand how we can, meet them where they need to be met.
That's a great example of local impact. Besides the local level, you also hold several roles across influential platforms on a global scale, from CLIVAR, CLIVAR to Oceans Predict. Briefly, can you tell us about those platforms and then how these global collaborations enhance the impact of your work and build into the UN Decade of Ocean Science?
Course. So, CLIVAR, it's an international organization, well, made up of scientists really, to better understand climate variability in the atmosphere and in the ocean. And it's made up of working groups that are focused on different parts of the ocean. So you'll have the Atlantic Research Panel and the Indian Ocean Research Panel, for example. The Ocean Prediction Decade Collaborative Center, for example, is again a multinational organization that aims to support better coordination and connection around the world in terms of ocean modeling, so that ocean models are interoperable and that we can share data and information more easily. So those are just two examples. And the real importance of Africa and South Africa being represented on these global bodies is Not just for knowledge transfer, that goes both ways, by the way. So we learn from the North and we also teach the North about what's happening in the South, in the global South. But it's also really such an important stage for African developments to be shared. I think that, it's so easy for us to be forgotten in the global South because there are fewer scientists working in the global South. And it is more important than ever that we are on the global stage. We're part of this show, and that we actually raise our voices and share what is being done in Africa, because it is really incredible. There's a lot of amazing stuff being done here, and I think we've got a lot to teach the global North, actually, in terms of moving forward in a way that is sustainable and that impacts the most vulnerable of societies, who will be most impacted actually by climate change. So it's very important that we are in those working groups, and in that way, we will be able to support the objectives of the Ocean Decade, in a meaningful way. Yeah.
Thinking about the mechanics of some of these elements, you mentioned the importance of the Global South, because obviously we live in a world economy. The fact that we are underrepresented from a scientist's point of view, that we don't have enough people. And thirdly, the importance of being able to be positioned in those working groups and to have a voice. So how do you manage to spread yourself across those different nodes for representation? And then as a skill, how do you ensure that the voice of the Global South is heard?
Yeah, that is a good question. And it's not always easy. So there's few of us on the ground in South Africa compared to other parts of the world, and we do find that we're called upon to represent a lot and across various global bodies and within various different projects. So it can be challenging. I've had the opportunity to give a keynote address on emerging forecast systems at an international ocean prediction symposium, which for me was really important to spread the message of what is going on in the global South. So I presented on behalf of South Africa as well as India, as emerging systems. And I think that it was really eye-opening for the people in the audience, who were all generally from well-resourced European or American institutes, to see what was going on in emerging systems. The fact that solutions that were being developed were cost-effective, sustainable, really fit for purpose, and they really had to support something tangible. We don't have the, I don't know, the luxury in under-resourced countries to just do something because it's fun. We really need to produce something useful. So I think the more we have the opportunity to engage with the Global North, whether it's in a presentation or whether it's in a networking event, I think we need to go ahead and do that and just be proud of what we're doing, because it is good.
It's great that you're doing purpose-driven work. I always think that that holds so much more impact than a lovely model sitting on the shelf that is all very theoretical. But that absolutely doesn't take away from the academic rigor and the practice that goes into things and the passion that you have for developing the next generation. What inspires you about mentoring upcoming ocean scientists, and also thinking in this practical layer, what are some of the gaps they're helping to close?
So it's interesting. Just getting to know, are there millennials? I don't know, but the students that I'm generation, I don't know, millennials who I'm mentoring and supervising, they were born into a world of information that is accessible at the touch of a button. So their mine seem to work differently to mine and my colleagues, you know, whereas we'll read a whole manuscript and like rigorously go through everything. They seem to be able to integrate and absorb this all of this information in a different way than we do. And I think they also have the potential to, well, they see things differently. So the potential for innovation is huge. And I think that, you know, they will find a way to integrate all of what's come before them, this world of information, in some way that we can't even imagine. And I think they're really important to drive us into a future that's sustainable. And I'm really excited to see where they're going to go with this. But they really are different from our generation, and that is exciting, actually. It's exciting to see where we're going to go.
Exciting. And are there any reservations because they do see the world differently?
Well, you know, I think if we, I think for me, if I can at least give them a passion for the ocean and a passion for ensuring its preservation, the ocean, but also the marine life in the ocean, I think those reservations fall away. My worries and concerns fall away. I think if I can at least instill in them the kind of passion that I have about the ocean, I'm certain that they will use their tools that I don't even know what those tools will be, but I'm certain that they will find the right kind of tools, the appropriate tools, to lead us towards a sustainable future. Yeah, so in terms of reservations, there might be some, but I think if as long as they're passionate, I think things will go the right way. Yeah.
And on this type of evolutionary note, in the past, oceanography was a traditionally male-dominated field. Can you share what have been some of the challenges and opportunities you've experienced as a woman in this space?
Yeah, so things have changed a lot since I, started my career. But for me, a big challenge, and this isn't as bad as it used to be, but a big challenge was being heard. You know, I would frequently sit in a meeting, primarily made up of men, and my dear colleague, who was my peer, male, he would always. Whatever he said was heard and noted, but I found that often if it came from me, it was kind of overlooked. It's happening less and less, but for me that was a very big challenge. Another challenge that my first role was as at a lecturer, and I was challenged in that. I was hired as an employment equity hire, or at least that was one of my colleagues told me to my face in a staff meeting. And none of the other colleagues stood up for me, and it was very hard for me to hear that. And so what I did was to prove him wrong and really just to be the best I could be. And I think I've succeeded. But it's not easy to hear that. That you're an employment equity hire. So, and I'm sure that happens to many people, as a woman. But I think you just need to use that as inspiration to prove everybody wrong that it's actually not the case. But the biggest thing is having our voices heard. I think that is probably the most underlying thing that remains, in many fora. Yeah.
And given your experience, what do you think we need to do to have our voices heard? What are some of the elements that or tactics, strategies
Yeah.
that we can apply?
I think you just need to keep on speaking out. I really don't know what more there is to it, but speaking out, but also following through. I feel that many people will speak out a lot and yet there's no action. So I think if we can speak up, but then also follow through with what we've said, then that will make a big difference. You know, we can actually show that what we say, we mean, and we'll follow through, which is not true of everybody who speaks the loudest at these conferences.
Yep. So that's proof in what you're doing and proof in the voice behind it. Hearing about the amazing work that you do and what your colleagues do, I've always found really fascinating. Is there perhaps a story that you want to share from one of your students or collaborators which has really impressed you in the ocean science space?
You know, there's so many, but I will share with you the story of one of my PhD students, and she comes from Limpopo province, and
No oceans
she,
there.
no, she came from the mountains, and she came to UCT. I think she had in mind to do something different from oceanography. I can't remember what it was, but she ended up in my undergraduate oceanography class. I remember her clearly. She was so fastidious, but also dedicated to her work. She would meet in my office often, worried that she was going to fail, and she didn't. She continued to do her master's and her PhD that I assisted with supervising her, and now she became the first Black female PhD in physical oceanography in South Africa, and she, I think she was in the Mail and Guardian's top 200 most influential women a few years ago, Dr. Mogabo Ragoasha. She's based at UCT. And now she's a lecturer at UCT, and she's passionate about transformation and capacity development. And I believe that given her background and her passion, she will make a huge generation in the next era, you know, the next generation of female ocean scientists. She works really hard at developing this capacity development in oceanography, and she will make a huge difference. So aside from all of that good stuff, she's also an amazing scientist who's a numerical modeler who's passionate about you know, the South Africa's coastal ocean. So she really is an inspirational story for me, from the mountains to the ocean. And she's also a Sangoma, which is really, really something.
She sounds like she's going to make a big impact in the discipline. And also, one of the things that I've heard in our, or let's say one of the takeaways from our conversation today is that it's not just about the work that you do in isolation, but it's about the bigger picture, the integrations, the impact on other stakeholders, the interconnectivity, that nothing we do is isolated.
Absolutely. And more so than ever, we need to work together, you know, in a sense of Ubuntu. You know, it's I am because we are. And I feel that needs to shine in everything we do, in all the work we do. We need to do it with purpose.
And that segues nicely into the latter part of our conversation, which is more on a personal level. And one of the questions that I ask all my guests is about some of the factors that they feel have contributed to their success. Sometimes people would talk about a particular person or values or discipline. Please share with us what have been some of your key drivers.
Oh gosh. What has been, I would say my passion for the ocean, my love and my love of the story of the Earth system, so of the oceans and the stars and the moon that drive the tides, and how that leads to coastal erosion and how that drives our lithosphere. For me, it's the passion that really drives my interest in what I do. So that's the first thing. But the next thing I would say is the ability or the potential to make a real difference in that field, you know, to produce work that supports a future that my children will live in. And you know, for me, that really is a driving factor in what makes me successful. You know, I really want to make sure that I'm making a difference. My colleagues, I mean, my colleagues and my peers, both locally and internationally, my team, they're all part of the success. Yeah, I think just my drive to be the best that I can be, and also an element of terror and an element of worrying that I'm not enough. And so I work harder, I think. I really do all my homework and I prepare well for things. Because perhaps that's just my self-doubt, but I find that I prepare well as I can for something, especially if it makes me nervous. So yeah, I think those are oh, and of course, having a healthy work-life balance. For me, that is really important. Taking the time when you need it to be with your family or just to be by yourself, not to constantly be at working is really, really important to have some sort of balance in your lifestyle. Yeah, so those are a few examples of the things that I think help me succeed. And when I'm out of balance and off kilter, it's generally because there's something lacking. I'm there's something missing, which could be not enough me time or not enough downtime. So it's important just to manage expectations as well.
Thank you for sharing some of your drivers. I want to tap into that last one that you spoke about on finding your balance. And sometimes I think that we are so driven by our commitments to work and fulfilling our obligations in that space that we can neglect our other life. How do you manage it and how do you negotiate it?
Oh, it's not always easy, and I think it come it has its ups and downs. You know, when we're particularly busy, it's really hard to it's easy enough to stop work to put the laptop away, but then it's always on your mind. So that is the real challenge, is not just to have your plan. I'm not going to work after this time, or I'm going to wake up early so that I can have that little bit of time for myself. It's easy to do that, but the difficult part is clearing your mind and just remembering to be mindful. And how do I do that? I mean, I think everybody has their own ways of doing that, but meditation helps, yoga helps me, being in nature helps me, being active, going surfing with my kids, and just shifting my focus physically, actually, I think is most important. Doing physical activity is important for me. So that really does help. Yeah. But the trick is the mind, just getting your mind right and just letting work leave the mind when you've stopped.
That's so true. You can have all this wonderful intent, and like you say, physically shutting things off and down. But if your mind is still on the subject, you actually have it turned off.
Absolutely.
And reflecting on some of the pivotal moments in your life growing up, what would you say have been some of them that have shaped you?
Gosh, well, I think when I think of this in terms of where I am with my career and what I've chosen as a career path, I would say for me, a big one is growing up in Cape Town. The ocean and the mountains are really an integral part of my life. And I've always felt a little bit lost when I'm not close to the ocean or the mountains. I feel a bit, it doesn't seem right to me. So I've always been passionate about oceans and and mountains and the earth system, as I said earlier. So that led me to my double major degree in oceanography and geology. So those two were my foundation into to where I am now. And that's where I learned about how the hydrosphere and the cryosphere and the lithosphere and the biosphere all connected together. And it's a beautiful story of how our planet operates. For me, this is just the most beautiful, this fantastic story. And then I continued to do a postdoc. And I think for me, it's a small thing, but it really stands out in my mind is when I came into the oceanography department at the time, many years ago, wanting to do my honors, I think. The oceanography head of department opened his arms and said, "Welcome. Are you here to do your oceanography?" And it's a small thing, but my goodness, it really stands out in my mind. And from then, it was honors, master's, PhD. But through all of that, I felt this enormous imposter syndrome until very recently. And I still do, but it's become much better. And I just want to share that I would say in the last maybe 2 or 3 years, I finally have started to feel at ease and comfortable with myself when I'm representing South Africa and myself at international and local conferences and symposia. I feel like that moment when I really started to believe in myself that I have a place on the stage. It was just a pivotal moment for me. So now, when I go to conferences and when I'm on the plane headed off to a very big conference, I'm not sitting there terrified and worried about how I'm going to come across. I'm actually excited, and I attend with joy and happy to share what we're doing. So for me, that was probably the most recent and possibly most important turning point in my career so far. Yeah.
Thanks for sharing that with us. It's such an important mind shift, and I think it's definitely a common experience, a common phenomenon that women experience.
And I
So,
think it all comes from inside. As you grow, I think no one else can tell you you're good enough. You need to believe it. And that's been a turning point for me.
And lastly, as we close today's conversation, please share a few words of inspiration to impart to girls and women listening to us.
Well, I would say that you should step out of your comfort zone, even if it's scary. No, I think you should step out of your comfort zone, especially if it's scary, because I really think that is where you grow. That is how you grow. If you do something that frightens you, do it anyway. Do it to the best of your ability. If you fail, you'll be better prepared for next time. So I would say, please just shoot for the stars. Move out of your comfort zone. Yeah.
That's such a great message. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Amalai. This has been a beautiful conversation. Thank you for having me.
You have been listening to Womanity, Woman in Unity, and we have been talking to Dr. Jennifer Veach, who is a physical oceanographer based at SEON and heads up the Somisana Initiative.